All right, panel two is about to begin, so if you can please start finding your seats. Thank you.
About 10 to 12 minutes.
Willie Loman, right?
Willie Loman.
Shelley leaves when she has to leave.
Yeah, yeah.
When you're finished,
you know,
I'll move it into moderated discussion. And then,
yes.
Hi, everyone. If you could please find your seats, we're going to start with the second panel.
Hemingways.
Uh-huh. And if you get through the second panel, then there's lunch. So the faster we sit down, the faster we get to eat.
Freshman English teacher assigned that I didn't read.
Allison.
Mr. Loman, can I look inside? I think I neglected to turn the power on.
It's just, considering that it's 70 years old, it's an incredible view into the outlook of black people in America in a different era, before Brown and Board of Education. It's a good book. It's a novel. It's a novel, but it's like, you know, you take this journey through the black experience. Yeah.
It's a smaller one. Are we all set to go here? Well, welcome to the GTI's panel number two, the TRA and Taiwan's International Space. We have four of probably the country's top experts on Taiwan, and it's at least two of the experts on its international space. First, we'll have Ambassador Steve Young, or is it Ambassador Dr. Steve Young? First time we met was in Taipei in 1982, and Steve's Chinese is okay at that point. And I wondered why was he at the AIT Taipei? Well, he had just finished his PhD in Soviet studies, so his Russian was quite good.
Not Soviet, Russian.
Yes.
There's a big difference.
Steve will talk first. Number two will be Shelley Rigger, who needs no introduction, except to say that she's probably I'm trying to think of anybody else. She's probably the expert on Taiwan domestic politics in the United States, who is not him or herself a Taiwanese, with the possible exception of Mike Fonte, but Mike doesn't. and Shelley's written several books, both of which are essential reading for anybody that's an expert in Taiwan. Third, we'll have Dr. Richard Bush. Again, Richard Bush needs no introduction. He's spent a lot of time on Capitol Hill. He was national intelligence officer for East Asia. He was then plucked from that job prematurely and forced to serve as chairman of AIT for a number of years. I don't know anybody that, and I first knew him back in 1979 when I was on the Taiwan desk and he was on Capitol Hill. And he's been involved deeply in Taiwan affairs ever since then.
Thank you.
Last but not least, Walter Lohman, my former boss at the Heritage Foundation. Walter is an expert in U.S. Southeast Asian relations. He'll, I think, find himself a little bit overpowered when it comes to Taiwan's international space in the U.S.-Taiwan context. And he'll look at Taiwan's new strategy of the southbound policy, which is a pretty intensive departure from where Taiwan has been going in the last 12 years. Lee Teng-hui had a southbound policy, and the new policy, I think, is going to yield great benefits. I don't want to keep us here too long. The idea is to have each of the speakers speak from 10 to 12 minutes. I will then pick up on that and have a sort of a moderated discussion for a little while, ask maybe 10 to 12 minutes of questions and answers, and then we'll throw it open to questions from the audience. Hopefully, we'll be done in about an hour and 10 minutes. So can I ask Ambassador Young, Dr. Young, Professor Young?
Don't call me late for supper.
Professor Young has, by the way, perhaps the most experience in Taiwan, except for me. you were there in the 1962 to
63 to 65.
So that was 55 years ago. So you can imagine how old he is.
Very young.
Go ahead, Steve.
I was going to say some nice things about you, John, but now I'm not so sure. I'm really pleased to be here, and congratulations to Chairman Lai and to Russell Hsiao for the incredibly rapid growth of GTI over the last year. John and I do have some roots going back to Taiwan. Our fathers both served in the military advisory group at different eras, but as a result, I have had the pleasure of watching Taiwan grow from what was a fairly modest little place in 1963 when I arrived with water buffalo and coolies in the fields to a high-tech center. It's always great to be with Richard Bush, Shelley, both leading lights in Taiwan studies and people from whom I've learned a lot. As far as TRA is concerned, I think what's remarkable about this 38-year-old document is less its specific language and more the spirit of creativity that practitioners of Taiwan policy have applied to it. For example, the desire of Taiwan's friends here in America and around the world to maximize this remarkable island's engagement and participation in the world continues to ensure that the 23 million people of Taiwan and their representatives around the world have a meaningful voice in matters that concern them. I had the privilege of working with some of the central architects of U.S. policy toward Taiwan in my 33-plus years in government, among them David Dean, Jim Lilly, and Kurt Campbell, who never worried too much about what they could not do under the TRA, so much as calculating what was possible in the practical realm. This, of course, involved assuring that we treated our Taiwan counterparts with all the respect and dignity that representatives of this great island deserved. I remember accompanying Stan Brooks to the airport in early 1982 when Jim Lilly flew in to assume his responsibilities as AIT director. Stan was very old school and worried that Jim would go around the TECRA reps to talk directly with the MFA folks, particularly Fred Chen, at the airport, and worse yet, maybe speak substantively with the local press. Well, Jim proceeded to jump right in, later told me that it was the obligation of those involved in relations with Taiwan to treat their representatives with every bit of dignity and respect that they deserved. And I think that was sound advice that I've been able to follow to the best of my ability over the years that I've been working on Taiwan. Jim, as many of you remember, had worked for George Bush Sr. in the early liaison office back in the 1970s. And so he also understood that the Chinese only respect fairness, firmness, when matters of principle are concerned. People like Jim, and later Kurt Campbell, focused particularly on Taiwan's defense needs, grounded in the language of the TRA, but also in the evolving military needs of the island. When it comes to Taiwan's international space, one can look at two major facets. First, that cluster of nations misnamed by Taiwan officials as allies that maintain formal diplomatic relations with Taiwan. To be honest and perhaps a little blunt, I'm not sure I could locate many of them on a map, and they are generally small enough that blandishments of foreign assistance keep them in the Republic of China fold. Another battlefield, if I may misuse the title of that concern, is in international organizations like WTO, the WHO, and so forth. And here, the struggle has always been centered squarely on what Beijing will permit. Developments since President Tsai Ing-wen took office demonstrate how little one can expect from Xi Jinping on this score, in my opinion. I think it's pretty clear where Xi is coming from. Unwilling and perhaps unable under the rules of governance of the game for today's Communist Party to contemplate genuine democratic reform at home, Xi has instead fanned nationalistic passions among China's young citizens. Therefore, in Xi's game plan, Taiwan is unfinished business in modern China's march to glory. For a while, things seem to be going well for Xi there. Former President Ma Ying-jeou, a mainlander at heart, was prepared to deal with Beijing in a very accommodating manner, one that Xi naturally embraced. But Madam Tsai's election ended that diplomatic truce and ushered back in the sort of hostile PRC attitude we veterans of the Chen Shui-bian era remember well. As some of you have heard me say before, I believe the real foundation of Taiwan's continued vitality in the global community lies with those countries willing to work productively with Taiwan even without the trappings of formal diplomatic relations. I would posit that the first rank of these countries consists of the United States, Japan, Singapore, and Australia, although others in Asia and Europe, certainly the EU, are also important trade and business partners with Taiwan. Friends of Taiwan here in the US, whether in government, Congress, business, or academia, should continue our active effort to maintain these vital ties, both to promote Taiwan's economic and commercial progress, and also to ensure that our friends there have the military hardware and expertise to complicate any rash threats emanating from across the strait. In the meantime, while many of us hope someday the mainland will catch up with the rest of the modern world and liberalize its political system, until that time, we need to ensure that Taiwan has the tools to resist the bullying and coercion that have become stock in trade for people like President Xi Jinping. The TRA, creatively interpreted with modern realities, gave us the mechanism needed to support the autonomous and free development that the people of Taiwan deserve. And it continues to do that today. So as we meet here, it is on the Korean Peninsula that American policymakers are attentive and concerned. That and the mercurial character of the man in the White House. But creative efforts to keep the peace in the Taiwan Strait must never tempt us to lessen our commitment to the people of what the Portuguese long ago termed the beautiful island. With that, I look forward to the comments of my colleagues and to the questions that might arise afterwards. Thank you again.
Thanks, Steve. Shelley?
Thank you. It's really great to be here. I have been so impressed and delighted by the accomplishments of GTI in its very short existence. I had the pleasure of spending about 8 weeks in Washington this summer teaching a summer program, so it allowed me to spend time at GTI and attend their events, and I was just really, really impressed with the range of topics and the quality of the speakers. And so congratulations, truly. This is really a wonderful addition to the landscape of organizations thinking about and helping Americans understand Taiwan. I also need to apologize. I have a teaching obligation this evening in Davidson, which is near Charlotte, North Carolina. So I'm going to have to leave perhaps even before the panel is all the way completed. But I still wanted to come to this event because I knew that there would be so many people that I wanted to learn from and hear from and meet with. So I'm sorry that I haven't provided, you know, sort of the full commitment, but I really am glad to be here. And honestly, the first panel was worth the trip. I learned a lot. And it's a really, really thought-provoking and sobering set of ideas that we were given in the first panel. So I often think of the TRA as kind of in that fairy tale of Sleeping Beauty. The TRA is kind of the last fairy, right? All the fairies came in and they gave gifts to the baby Aurora. And then the angry fairy came in, and the angry fairy came in and she said, "Here's my gift. I'm going to curse this baby. When she turns 16, she's going to prick her finger on a spindle and die." But fortunately, there was one more fairy who hadn't yet given her gift. And she came in and she said, "I can't change the curse, but I can soften it. So instead of dying, she will fall asleep for 100 years. And I think that's sort of what the TRA did for Taiwan. You know, it said, "I can't change the fact that the Nixon administration has made the decision to normalize relations with the PRC and to terminate relations with the Republic of China." But Congress, as that final fairy, said, "But we can soften this decision by continuing to have as substantive and meaningful and productive a relationship as is possible within the larger frame of normalization with the PRC." And so I feel like maybe I am the 13th fairy, or the last fairy, now speaking to you after the first panel, trying to bring a slightly different perspective, or at least inviting us to remember some aspects of U.S. foreign policy that are sometimes very hard to keep in mind and keep in the forefront of our thinking when we are confronting what are, in fact, very serious strategic challenges to the U.S. and to the global community. So another way that I think about U.S. foreign policy and the TRA and normalization as part of U.S. foreign policy is, you know, there's an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other shoulder, and they're both whispering into the ears of policymakers. And I'm not going to say which one is the angel and which one is the devil, but I see two forces acting, and these are forces that are rooted in kind of human logic, but they are elaborated in theories of international relations, and they are argued both in theoretical terms, we heard some of that in the first panel, and also in policy and kind of empirical terms, and we heard some of that in the first panel as well. So on the one shoulder are the realists, who say, if we think about it from the standpoint of IR theory, right, the only thing that matters in international relations is power and strategic position, strategic advantage. So our foreign policy needs to be driven by a calculation of power and a calculation of the strategic advantage that can secure the interests of the United States and sometimes, and more often in the policy world than in the theoretical world, our friends and allies. Well, our allies are part of the theory too. And it was really this logic that drove the rapprochement with the PRC back in the early 1970s. The calculus that that China could be a strategic asset to the U.S. in the Cold War competition against the Soviet Union. So, you know, in a way, the U.S. was following Chairman Mao's theory of contradictions, right? That primary contradiction is with the Soviet Union, so we should make an alliance with the PRC, or at least we should have a better relationship with the PRC in order to confront the Soviet Union from a position of greater strength. And because the commitment that Nixon and Kissinger had to this realist understanding of the world and this realist sort of ideology of how the world works was so strong, they were willing, the historical record suggests, to let nature take its course with respect to Taiwan. That they were not particularly concerned about preserving a relationship with Taiwan that would allow Taiwan to continue as an autonomous political entity beyond some reasonable transitional interval after normalization. The TRA, though, corrected that error. And I think that is in part because there were others who looked at the Taiwan case from a realist standpoint and said, actually, we need Taiwan for many of the strategic reasons that were described in the previous panel. But there were also many people in Congress who were guided by the other angel, which is the angel of liberalism, to use again the parlance of international relations theory, the idea that it is not only power and security and sort of strategic advantage that matters in international relations, but also other more cooperative imperatives meaningfully exist in the relationships among states. So economics matters, and values matter. Having states that share a particular point of view, a particular world view or set of priorities in their own domestic, political, and economic life is valuable and in and of itself. So the one angel says, you know, whatever it takes to accomplish our strategic advantage is what we should do. And the other angel says, we need to temper our strategic thinking with some sense of values and of the opportunities that international relations presents, as well as the threats that are inherent in the relations among states. And the last point I would like to make is just thinking now about what these two points of view imply for U.S.-Taiwan relations in the present. So clearly, if we attend to values, if we care about cultivating and nurturing states in the international community that are democratic, that embrace genuine free market economics, and so on, then we have to worry about the fate of Taiwan. We have to at least, even if we can't ensure Taiwan's future, we ought to at least pay attention and put effort into acting in accordance with our values when it comes to Taiwan. So the one advisor on our shoulder, which might be an angel or might be a devil, says, you know, you got to care about Taiwan because values matter and because there are a lot of opportunities for the U.S. through this relationship and through sort of remaining true to the essence of the TRA and the spirit of creativity, which I think is a really valuable phrase to keep in mind about the TRA. On the other shoulder, though, it's not so obvious what the policy recommendation is about Taiwan. Because on the one hand, there is always the possibility that the strategic advantage to the U.S. might be most readily secured and pursued by abandoning Taiwan, right? And this was the first of the three schools of thought that Mike Green suggested, the sort of accommodationist grand bargain. You know, we can't afford this Taiwan thing anymore. We just need to let it go. But another possibility is that from a realist perspective, we may decide that we need to use Taiwan as a strategic, as a tool of a strategic competition with China, that Taiwan becomes a kind of weapon for the U.S. to use against China. So what appears to be a pro-Taiwan policy is in fact an anti-China policy in which Taiwan is deployed as an instrument or tool or weapon. And I would say that either of those is problematic and needs to be, again, tempered with an understanding of values. Because both of those two approaches, driven by this kind of realist calculus, which is never untempered or unmitigated or uninfluenced by aspects of liberalism, but sometimes can be very ascendant, either of those two approaches treats Taiwan as a means to the end of a particular U.S. position. And I would argue that in the long run, we will be truer to our own values as Americans if we remember that Taiwan is also an end in itself and not simply a tool or a means to the ends of others, be they others in Beijing or others in the U.S. Thank you.
What, which tone do I hit?
Right.
Okay. Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. Congratulations to GTI on its first annual conference. And thanks to GTI for doing what you do every week of the year to help keep Taiwan more at the forefront of consciousness here in Washington, D.C. and around the United States. I realize that we have experienced a very special moment. This is the first time in my too long career that the tale of Sleeping Beauty has been used to explain Taiwan. And it may be the last, and that makes it all the more special, right?
You have grandchildren, don't you?
No,
she has two daughters. She has two daughters. I'm going to talk about what the topic says, and that's the TRA and what the TRA says about the issue of international space. I realized when I saw Jacques Delisle sitting out in front of 1777 F Street that might have been a mistake, because Jacques really knows what he's talking about when it comes to law. I mean, I will warn you at the outset that I actually do not believe that the TRA as law says what many of us think it says about Taiwan's international space. However, that does not matter. What is important in all of this is whether or not U.S. policymakers decide that as a matter of policy, promoting Taiwan's international space and helping it play the kind of constructive role that it can is in the national interest of the United States. So let me sort of jump to my presentation. What we're talking about is Section 4 of the TRA, particularly subsection 4 of Section 4, and that's what we have on the screen. Just
Section 4, subsection 4 says, nothing in this act shall be construed as a basis for supporting the exclusion or expulsion of Taiwan from continued membership in any international financial institution or any international organization. And that sounds good, but what is important in terms of the actions of the executive branch is how the executive branch interprets these sections and how the executive branch evaluates the way in which laws require it to do things, forbid it to do things, allow it to do things, or something different. There is an office in the Department of State called the Office of Legal Counsel, L for short, that is the true gatekeeper on these issues. And they are the ones that look at something like the TRA and ask, you know, what do we have to do here? What are we forbidden from doing? What can we get away with? And so we need to keep in mind the very talented lawyers in that office when thinking about what the executive branch actually does in response to things like this subsection. Now, I think the text needs to be read carefully for what it says and what it doesn't say. Well, never mind. There's note at the end of this subsection, the phrase continued membership. Now, on its face, this formulation covered organizations where Taiwan is still present and not where it is not. And so the executive branch interpretation would be, well, this doesn't require helping Taiwan get into new organizations. That provision mentions international financial organizations, and it's probably a reference to the IMF and the World Bank. I think that this was the true motivation for this section, that Taiwan was still in the IMF and the World Bank at the time that the TRA was being legislated. It didn't want to be driven out, and so it sought the help of its friends in Congress in creating a defense mechanism. And, you know, the question is where, you know, whether it served as a good defense mechanism. In fact, the Carter administration, in principle, supported the PRC taking over China's membership in the IMF and the World Bank, really didn't do anything to help Taiwan preserve its position. The Reagan administration did a better job in preserving Taiwan's membership in the Asian Development Bank. I mean, if you look at this provision, it also doesn't really say anything about what the executive branch should do. You know, when the Congress really wants the executive branch to do something, it says the president shall. Not should, but shall. That word shall is a very powerful word in legislative construction. So this one says, nothing in this act shall be construed as a basis for supporting exclusion or expulsion, et cetera, et cetera. To my reading, you know, as somebody who worked on Capitol Hill and knows how these games are played, I think all this is saying to the executive branch is, if you choose to support the exclusion or expulsion of Taiwan from international organizations, don't blame the TRA. I think that's all it says. So we have a section that says less than it seems to say. What we can say is that the spirit of this section is that on balance, we support Taiwan being in the international community, but as a matter of law, it doesn't. Now, you can ask what's going on here. Why is this language so weak for an objective that is worthy of support? The answer to these questions, I think, involves a couple of different factors. There's this issue of legislative construction, which I've already mentioned. Second was the politics surrounding the passage of the TRA. First of all, the Congress was working under the gun to get this bill out the door and onto President Carter's desk. May 31st was the day that we were going to establish diplomatic relations with Taiwan, and the Congress very much wanted to finish the bill before that day. It felt probably that it had more leverage to get what it wanted if it acted before March 31st, and it succeeded in that. On the other hand, the floor managers of this bill, the chairman and ranking member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, did want to pass a bill that President Carter would sign. Not just any bill, but a bill that the president would sign. So the dirty little secret is that behind the scenes of the writing of the TRA, key members and their staff and officials of the executive branch were working together to get a text that could be sold to Congress but also sold to President Carter. President Carter would choose to interpret as not binding him in any serious way. And that's what we come up with. This is not the only place that that happened. The goal was to get a bill. I would note that the Carter administration had already undercut the TRA in a way when it comes to international organizations because it had recognized the government of the People's Republic of China as the sole legal government of China. And what that means is that PRC gets China's seat in the in international organizations and sort of Taiwan's left out in the cold. Now, let me touch on the rest of Section 4 very briefly. This has to do with something called the application of laws. Section 4 in various ways says that when U.S. law refers to countries or nations as the objects of U.S. law and programs, these laws and programs should apply to Taiwan. I think the purpose of this of these provisions was technical, not substantive. It was very important that the agencies of the executive branch have guidance on whether to apply specific law to Taiwan or not. There was care taken to make sure that this in no way suggested that Taiwan was a sovereign state. So this is the realm of law. TRA is weaker than we think. As the spirit of the law is something we all agree with, but the letter of the law really doesn't. In the realm of power, which Shelley has talked about, once China gets into any of these international organizations, it has used its power to block Taiwan from any appreciable role. However, what is truly important is that for about 20 years, American policymakers have recognized and accepted and promoted the idea that Taiwan should play a larger role in international affairs, that it should not be excluded. One reason that policymakers came to this conclusion was that it was clear that the people of Taiwan wanted it. They wanted to participate in world affairs and do so with dignity. I think that one policy implication of this, of the situation we're in, where law and power and policy interact in various ways, is that Taiwan should not pursue this issue in a way that plays to China's strengths. And China's strength is its dominant position in most international governmental organizations. Taiwan should find ways in which it can play to China's weakness or play where where China doesn't play. I actually think that the university games that were just held in Taiwan is an excellent example of the very positive and constructive role that Taiwan can play. Thank you very much.
Walter?
Yeah, thank you. And thank you to GTI and Russell for having me here. John used the right word. In some ways, I'm overpowered here on the TRA. If I want to know something about the TRA, I take Richard's book off the shelf, or I look at John's old heritage work, and call Richard from time to time to ask him questions about it. So what I tried to do today is to find a niche somewhere I could be helpful. And since I have a foot in both worlds, that is in Taiwan and in many of the countries that Taiwan is now reaching out to as a part of its southbound policy, I thought it could be helpful to just expand a little bit on the international space half of the question that the panel is focused on. So I'm going to look at the new southbound policy and look at three basic questions here. Why it matters to the United States, why it's more feasible this time than it has been in the previous attempts at this, and number three, how the United States can help Taiwan in its effort to reach out to itself. First of all, why it matters to the United States. This is a question I get a lot when I talk to people about southbound here, because it's not immediately apparent why the United States should get involved as a third party in Taiwan's outreach to Indonesia or India or anybody else in the region. And I would say for a few reasons here. One is it's international space is important to us. It is important, like Mike said in the first panel, it is important that the United States prevent a single hegemon from controlling the Western Pacific in particular. And so the southbound policy, I would argue, is an integral part of Taiwan's effort to build international space. Obviously, its involvement in international organizations, I think its diplomatic allies are an important element of that. I think it's all of its unofficial representation around the world is very important in that. But I think the southbound policy, likewise, can be an essential part of its effort to expand its space. The second reason why it matters to the United States is it creates a context for U.S. policy in the region. The better Taiwan's reputation in Southeast Asia, in India, the more responsibly it behaves, the more soft power it's able to acquire, the easier it is for the United States to act on Taiwan's behalf. The better context for an arms sale from the United States, the better context for economic diplomacy with Taiwan, the better context for our efforts to get it accepted into international organizations. And then the third reason why it matters to the United States is because in and of itself, what Taiwan has to offer is good. It has a lot of expertise in medical field. It has expertise in HADR. It has expertise in supply chain management and that sort of thing that it can share with the region. And so in and of itself, it has things to offer that are good and that the region will embrace. Okay, moving to the question of why it's more feasible this time. Another question that comes up occasionally, usually by the people who are sort of more initiated in what southbound is all about is, well, we tried this before and it didn't work. You know, Li Dongwei tried it in a couple different iterations, and Chen Qiben tried it as well. Why is it going to work this time? And here I also have a few reasons to mention. Number one is the wariness of China that's growing in the region. There's a certain skepticism about China throughout Southeast Asia. I think that is very apparent when you're talking to the foreign ministries and officials and politicians in places like Singapore. Singapore is a perfect example too, because against all sort of common sense, the way I would see common sense, the Chinese over the last year or so have taken on Singapore. You know, of all the problems you have to deal with, why would you take on Singapore? You know, Singapore can be your friend if you're China, but they have taken Singapore on seizing their Terex vehicles in Hong Kong, taking them on in the non-aligned movement, calling them out on law of the sea statements they've made and things like that. So I would single out Singapore as a particular example of a country that is open to facilitating more Taiwanese involvement in Southeast Asia in particular. The one caveat here, though, especially dealing with Southeast Asia, is you can't make that tie too explicit. You can't make the tie between this effort and concern about China too explicit, because that will scare the Southeast Asians particularly off. I always talk about Southeast Asian countries as cats. You know, they're like cats. If you want to grab it, you have to sneak up on it very softly, you know, and then scoop it up. If you make sudden moves, they scatter. Okay, so you just have to give them plausible deniability. You reach out to them, build cultural links, build educational links, but don't make it explicit why you're doing it. They know why you're doing it. You don't have to tell everyone in the world why you're doing it. The second reason it's more feasible is the economics have changed. Back when Lee Teng-hui tried this, he was interrupted by the 1997-98 financial crisis, which suddenly made Southeast Asia much less attractive an environment for investment and trade. And China, by contrast, was improving in its attractiveness to foreign capital. And you had both of them join the WTO. And so at least on the economic side, there was less interest in investing by Taiwanese companies in Southeast Asia in particular. Another caveat on this account is, okay, so Taiwan has more to offer to the region economically, relatively speaking, than it did, 20 years ago. But it's not competing with China in that way. And I think that's another element we have to keep in mind, is that, okay, Taiwan has a lot to offer. They should make that clear to the Southeast Asians and South Asia, particularly India. But don't make it about a competition with China, because at this stage, that's kind of absurd. You know, the Chinese are talking about $1 trillion in global infrastructure spending, and Taiwan is talking about a $3 billion pot of money they're going to make available for public spending in the Go South countries. So don't make it about competition with China on the economic side, but just do it. And again, like the other point I made, the region will understand what you're doing. You don't need to make it explicit. The third way it's more plausible this time is that it's structured much differently. Tsai Ing-wen has structured this in really an ingenious way, I think, because I think she recognizes the latter point that I just made, that Taiwan doesn't have the resources to compete with China today on the economic side. But it has a lot of other things. It has its culture, it has its education, it has its experience, it has its democracy. There's a lot of things that it can offer to the region. And so she has housed the economic part of this in a much broader effort, a much longer term effort, to build a community that includes Taiwan, to build a community of Pacific, Indo-Pacific nations of which Taiwan is a part. And so that's something that she can actually accomplish, I think, over her term in office. The third point here, how the United States can help Taiwan in its effort to look south. I think we can talk more about Taiwan and about Taiwan's effort in our interaction with countries in Southeast Asia, Australia, et cetera. I mean, if I have one negative thing to say about southbound policy right now, is that I'm not sure many people know that there is a southbound policy outside of Taiwan. You know, if you look at the press, all the press on it is Taiwanese press. They're fighting about it. They're making, you know, they're giving details about it. They're getting it out there in the public. But I'm not sure that most of Southeast Asia, and particularly in India, really know that this thing is going on. So the United States can help talk it up in our conversations with our friends in those capitals. The second thing is to enhance a program called the GCTF, Global Cooperation and Training Framework. Enhance that program, make it much more active. There's been seven or eight workshops and training initiatives over the last 2 years. I think there's more that we can do on that, looking at things like HADR and disease prevention, areas where Taiwan has some expertise to offer. I'd also suggest that it be focused more on the region as opposed to, you still call it global, but when you think about how much Taiwan has to offer and how it can get the best bang for its buck, maybe you concentrate it a little bit and invite people from the region, give the region a much more a much bigger slice of the action in those. The third thing we can do to help, I think, is to have a very active trade policy vis-a-vis Taiwan. I'm not sure, honestly, except for the sort of broad reasons we all know why the United States cannot come to an initiative on a free trade agreement with Taiwan. It's just one of the first things that I talked to Ed Foner about when I got to the Heritage Foundation. I said, we should push for a free trade agreement with Taiwan. He said, yeah, that's a good idea. I mentioned it 30 years ago. So it has been around a long time. I don't know why you can't pull the trigger on it. If the United States can do it, then that will encourage others to move ahead with new initiatives as well. And by the same token, if the United States for some reason cannot bring itself to do this, how can you expect countries in the region that are much more dependent on China than we are to be able to do that? The fourth thing is that I think we could do more at a track two level with Taiwan. I think how, as Dan Klinman said in the previous panel, Taiwan has some experience to offer in terms of being in the crosshairs of China for the last 60 years, however you want to calculate. And I think they can offer more to attract to dialogues. There was a considerable amount of activity in Southeast Asia over the last 20 or 30 years, but it's fallen off. And many of the initiatives that Southeast Asia was involved in at a multilateral level through its think tanks have fallen off. So I think there's more that we can do, more places like Heritage could do, AEI, other organizations in town to bring Taiwan into a broader conversation about the region and not just isolated always in this niche area of concern. So with that, I look forward to the question and answer. I think I'm not an expert on the TRA, but just like any Washingtonian, I have a lot of opinions about it. So I'll be glad to talk about it. Right.
Thank you all very much. I might say that we have about 7 minutes left for Dr. Rigger, and that if you have any final notes or comments that you want to make before you leave, then I'll give you the opportunity now, or otherwise.
Yeah, I think we can go ahead and have conversation. I don't need to filibuster.
Great. Yes.
Hello, Ben Lawson, Navy. This question is for Dr. Rigger. So as you discussed the U.S. looking to promote democracy and generally a good thing with Taiwan, with the Taiwan Relations Act, of course, in 1979, Taiwan was not a democracy. So other than being a strategic partner, what did the U.S. see in Taiwan? And maybe you could even apply this to other countries in the region to show us that they would be this good thing for the world.
So that's a really important question and something that I was thinking about after I finished speaking that I should have elaborated more. Yeah, it's true that when the TRA was signed, Taiwan was still a single-party authoritarian state. But it was a single-party authoritarian state that was not only anti-communist, but also actively involved in a kind of free market economics that was very congenial to the U.S., and that was already, I would argue, showing the slightest green shoots of political transformation. And it was especially that period between 1972 and 1979 when Taiwan was given by fate a longer kind of runway to prepare itself for normalization than would otherwise have happened without Nixon's resignation and Mao Zedong's death in the middle of the decade. Taiwan was given time to kind of prepare for this change. And so Taiwanese were very involved in thinking about what the TRA would look like and helping to guide the creation of the TRA. And even in that process, I think there was some suggestion that they understood that Taiwan would be a better interlocutor, partner, friend to the U.S. if it undertook political change. So the political change that happened in Taiwan was kind of vestigial or infant in the 1970s, but accelerated really pretty quickly after the 1970s in this atmosphere that was created largely by the U.S. Congress of this is what you need to do, right? This is what you need to become in order to remain relevant to the U.S., in order to convert your value from simply a bulwark against communist expansion to a partner and friend and ally of the U.S. in a kind of comprehensive sense. So it is absolutely true that Taiwan has fundamentally altered its value to the U.S. through the process of democratization. But I think in some ways that is a much more robust and durable basis for a relationship, that Taiwan is across the board in alignment with fundamental values espoused by the U.S. government over many generations. And honestly, part of the motivation then for speaking in this way today is that I sense softness on the values question from the current administration. They go back and forth. Sometimes they talk about values. Sometimes they talk about how values are not very important. I don't think there's any value-based leadership from the top of this administration. So that, to me, is a very important challenge to Taiwan and to U.S. friends around the world, is if the U.S. were to abandon this generations-long commitment to values in its foreign policy, then what is the basis of Taiwan's importance to the U.S.? Taiwan can still fall back on these kinds of strategic, you know, first island chain, all of that. But does Taiwan really want to be, as someone said this morning, the point of the spear? You know, that is a scary characterization to me for the lives of 23 million people, that they are the point of a spear.
I would add that I was on the Taiwan desk at the time. Steve Young was in AIT at the time, and Dr. Bush was on Capitol Hill at the time. You must have your views on this. I recall when I was in Beijing on December 16, 1978, almost the first reaction from Taiwan was Jiang Jingguo canceled the elections. And that was, elections, you know, were put off for a year while Taiwan tried to digest this. And then almost a year later was the Kaohsiung incident, the marches and the courts martial in February and March of 1980, the murder of Lin Yisheng's family. Mm-hmm. And all of this involved Congress's reaction in a very strong way, especially the Democratic majority at the time, which is very human rights oriented, democracy oriented, as opposed to the Republicans at the time, which are very security oriented and Cold War oriented. But I can see what I'd ask your.
My perspective is that the Congress's view, sort of after normalization, was really up for grabs. The KMT regime had built a strong bulwark of support on anti-communist and just friendship grounds and other incentives as well. And after the Kaohsiung incident, the balance of power within the regime was very much on security and not on political reform. There did emerge, with the support and encouragement of Taiwanese Americans, a group of four members who promoted democracy and human rights. I worked for one of them. I think that, you know, there were Democrats who sort of took the traditional view of Taiwan and didn't emphasize democracy and human rights so much. But this idea that a democratic Taiwan would have a better claim on the friendship and support of the American people had entered the mix. And Chiang Jingguo bought that argument. And what really sprang this loose were events in Taiwan that led Zhang to decide that the last thing he did before he died was going to start the process of democratization. So it's a little more complicated than you were describing, but that was the direction in which at least some in Congress were going.
Steve, do you have any reminiscences from Taiwan at TRA?
I guess obviously Richard has made some very good points. I do credit Zhang Jingguo with a brilliant move. Two steps, actually. The first was his decision to begin to open up the political system, but also his choosing of Li Denghui, mm-hmm. A native Taiwanese, mm-hmm. to be his vice president and heir was an incredible preface to the remarkable democratization that Taiwan went through. And I do think that, I mean, the other thing is that the Chinese showed a side of them that many people have been trying to avoid in 1989. So between Taiwan's moving toward a more open society and China going backwards at a time when many hoped its economics progress would lead to political liberalization, created a very new environment in the 1990s in which some good things happened for Taiwan.
Well, the question is, of in 1989 you had Tiananmen, 1990, 91, 92 you had the Wild Lily movement, mm-hmm. in Taiwan that just sort of turned everything upside down. But did Congress's support and the administration's support during the Clinton and subsequent years change because of that, or was there more going on?
I think the general view was that Taiwan had become the sort of poster child for democratization in the non-sort of white world. And particularly in contrast to Tiananmen and all that it revealed about the CCP regime, it was day versus night.
Was that translated into anything that Taiwan could tangibly hold on to?
Were effort in the process of dealing with Tiananmen sanctions and in the process of dealing with the issue of linkage of China's MFN status to human rights, which was the key issue in the early 90s, Taiwan was able to use friends in Congress to get some benefits. And then you sort of very soon you slide into Li Denghui's desire to visit the United States. And the support, almost unanimous support of members of Congress that it so should be. And Clinton realized that he had lost that battle and so went ahead.
Yeah, I think absolutely. The change in Congress had an impact on our policy toward Taiwan. Largely because of that, because it bucked up the Clinton administration. The Clinton administration needed some spine, yes. on Taiwan. And the fact that Congress got so active in the 1990s, they were passing dozens of resolutions. The one on Li Denghui's visa and his speech at his alma mater being one of them. So the TSEA, you'll remember, sort of improving the the TRA as they saw it, didn't pass ultimately, but it did have an effect on spurring along some of those security issues. So I think it had a big impact. Going back to something Shelley was saying, her metaphor with the angel and devil on one side or another. I think for the most part, I can't go back to the 1970s and how this played out, but I would say Congress is the angel on Taiwan policy because it's not reliant on a single individual, the whims of a guy that comes into office. If Donald Trump comes into office and he decides he wants to sell Taiwan to China and that deals with the trade deficit problem, what's to stop them? It's hard to stop them. I mean, the bureaucrats can speak up and you can have a lot of civil society getting involved, but who's going to stop them? Congress is going to stop them. Mm-hmm. And there is a very deep reservoir of support for Taiwan and the Hill. It goes to sleep a little bit periodically, but it can always be revved up because of some of these fundamentals and the most important fundamental now really is this value mm-hmm. proposition mm-hmm. that's not going to change with time. It's not going to change with the calculations of realpolitik. It's there for good, and it will continue to support Taiwan.
I might have been thinking along those lines, but it seemed like kind of not so polite to suggest that the realists on the previous panel were somehow the devils in the room. but anyway, please forgive me. I need to go and attend to my students, but thank you.
Shelley, thank you very much.
Safe travel.
We have another 15 minutes for questions. I would like to go to the, I won't, but I would like to go to the people in the rear. I will ask Professor DeLille to ask his question because his name has been taken in vain here. So.
Yeah, out of respect.
I don't know if it's been taken away. Jacques DeLille, University of Pennsylvania and Foreign Policy Research Institute. Richard, you would have made a great lawyer. I mean that as a compliment. I know it often isn't used that way. But just a couple of responses to it. One is that I think some of the more mandatory parts of Section 4 that you're talking about were not purely technical. They also were partly the treat Taiwan as if it is still a government of a state. And that certainly ticked off the mainland mm-hmm. because they saw it as a violation of the communique and have complained. Ever since. And I wonder if another piece of the story that's a little more technical for the other Office of Legal Counsel, the one in Justice, is that we have a separation of powers issue. Congress is on firm ground in saying how Taiwan should be treated under U.S. law on domestic matters. When you get into things that look like diplomatic recognition, after all, Goldwater v. Carter turned out as mm-hmm. it did. And international organizations are a little bit in that space. So I think there may be some of that. And I think it's also Section 4 is, in some ways, the thing that laid the foundation for what has been a brilliant strategy by Taiwan, which I think plays to your comment about playing to its weakness, as playing to its strengths and not its weaknesses, which is the as-if strategy, to behave as if it were part of the UN mm-hmm. Human Rights Covenants, behave as if it were part of the non-proliferation regime and so on. And in a way, Section 4 does that. The U.S. treats it as if it's a state. What I wanted to ask you is whether the TRA is also important as a precedent foundation or is merely a symptom of this being an area where Congress mucks around in foreign policy in a way it often doesn't. I mean, the Taiwan issue really does stand out. Do you see the TRA as having been a foundation for that, or is it just a symptom of the success Taiwan has had in getting Congress to pay attention to it?
One factual point. Much of what became Section 4 was in the original administration's draft bill. They knew that they needed something like this. So it was strengthened in the process of developing the legislation, and in part because of interventions by the American business community in Taiwan. But I think that there was sort of an understanding from the outset that something like this was needed. Whatever you think about the Taiwan Relations Act as binding direction in sort of some of these controversial or sensitive issues like arms sales or international space, I think the fact that Congress asserted itself and the fact that our memories of that period focus on the assertion of congressional power serves as something of a check even today on administrations that would make mischief. You know, whether it truly was a success story, it is a success story because that's what we remember. And one aspect of the toughening up of the TRA was Congress's anger at not being consulted. That's an important lesson, too, that if you're going to do something as controversial as this, you know, get some people with you who understand why and can support you.
Yeah, Steve.
Well, as a sign of how successful the TRA has been, Jimmy Carter now tries to take credit for it. And he came to Taiwan when I was deputy director. I forget when.
Yeah, that's 99.
And gave a speech from which he, you know, took credit for it. And that's fine. I'm trying to remember who it was. Annette Liu or somebody stood up and said, "Hey, you know, not so fast."
Right.
But it has survived well because it has been kind of a spirit rather than a bunch of specific words. And I think Democratic and Republican administrations have acknowledged the importance of Congress to the relationship with Taiwan in a way that I think is complementary to the essential effort that the executive branch has to play in managing all this. And I can say nothing shows that more clearly than the growth and vitality of AIT today. I've gotten in trouble for this before, but someday, some year, they're going to open that damn new building.
I thought they opened it already.
2018, early 2018.
It's the carrot on the end of the stick.
Yeah. Is it the Nehu building?
As a guy who found the property in 1999, I have a vested interest in this, there's a book to be written about that.
Steve and I surveyed property behind a dike that sort of periodically flooded, and we agreed at that time that we did not want AIT.
That's right, because the Taipei American School reminded us of the flooding that they abandoned when they moved to the new site.
Yeah, I would just interject that when I came on the Taiwan desk 38 years ago, reading the Taiwan Enabling Act, which was the U.S. government's, was the State Department's version, and the TRA, to see where the differences were, the wording was very much the same in a lot of areas that I didn't expect, and one of which was this Section 4. Of course, all of Section 2, which said it shall be the policy of the United States, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, that was all sort of put in there. Mm-hmm. And then Section 3, which mandated that the president make available to Taiwan, he said that the president shall make available to Taiwan such defense articles, that wasn't in it. And it didn't. The further mandate was that the president shall make his decisions on arms sales to Taiwan based solely on his view of Taiwan's defense needs in consultation with the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this wound up being honored more in the breach than the observance. But I think the whole idea that the TRA was very supportive of U.S. support for Taiwan's continued participation in international organizations, I think that was in from the beginning, and I think the State Department had that as part of the Enabling Act.
Don't remember.
Yeah. It also mandated that all treaties continue in force. I had thought that the Congress had put that in, but that was part of the original Taiwan Enabling Act. And because of that, the State Department and Ambassador Woodcock, the State Department said, we cannot terminate the mutual defense treaty on the basis of breaking relations with the Republic of China alone. And this is where I think Senator Goldwater, his reactions. I don't know if Senator Helms was even around at that point. Senator Scott of Pennsylvania, the wind was sort of taken out of their sails because they tried to complain that the administration was terminating the mutual defense treaty without consulting the Senate. And indeed, what happened was is that the State Department said, no, we're terminating it under the terms of the treaty, mm-hmm. so it doesn't. But to me, it was it's a very instructive thing to read both texts. We have three more minutes. Five more minutes.
Six.
Mr. Bob,
I'll be D7. That's my final offer.
At the very end there, yes.
Okay, thank you. My name is Qin Qiang. I come from Fudan University, Shanghai, and now I'm pursuing a one-year visiting scholarship at Johns Hopkins. And I'm very glad to be here today to meet a lot of old friends. I have a question to Richard. Okay. And concerning the international space issue of Taiwan. And basically, we see there are two approaches for Taiwan to explore international space. One is through Beijing, and another is through Washington. That is, first is just like diplomatic truce conducted across the Taiwan Strait. And the second is to ask Washington to pass a bill and to say something to impose pressure upon Beijing. And now that we know this thing, I think that Tsai Ing-wen trying to pursue maybe the second approach. And we know that the tension across the Taiwan Strait is increasing. So my question is, what do you think about the prospect of the international space issue of Taiwan in the coming 3 or 4 years? And it will shrink? It will expand, or it will maintain the status quo? Thank you.
Great. We don't have a whole lot of time, but other people did have questions, and I wanted to make sure. If you have a short question, maybe Joe Bosco, and then... Yes, and then you. Yes.
thank you, John. That was a superb panel, as well as the one earlier this morning. And I think it came across loud and clear in this morning's panel that both from a moral and idealistic standpoint and geographically, Taiwan is critical to U.S. national interests in Asia. It's a slam dunk based on what we heard from the first panel this morning. Now, for all the wonders of the TRA, which I do as well applaud, it does have an element of strategic ambiguity. While we provide defense articles for Taiwan, there's not a commitment for the defense of Taiwan. And I wonder if you gentlemen would like to comment on whether the Trump administration will relook at that issue and whether it should.
Okay, there are, the first question is about Taiwan's international space going through Washington or Beijing in the coming years, and what are the prospects? Joe's look at Taiwan's U.S. strategic relationship in the Trump administration, and then maybe I could ask you to.
Thank you, John. Hongbin Ding, Loyola University, Maryland. My question is for Mr. Lohman, is about the southbound policy. So it's really interesting to hear that the question about how can U.S. help being asked here in Washington. Now, more specifically, I'm wondering, how exactly should Taiwan sell the idea of southbound policy to our friends in Washington? Who are the people who are most likely to listen? And how should Taiwan message this package so that it become easy for whoever is listening to incorporate idea and take action to help out? Now, a second part of this messaging question, is that, well, after all, Chai Tsai Ing-wen is under pressure to prove that this southbound policy can work. So from the Tsai Ing-wen government's point of view, and also from the Washingtonian friend's point of view, what are the priorities for Tsai government to initiate, to engage the Southeast Asian countries so that in about a year or 2 years of time, then the Thai government can sail back to the taxpayers in Taiwan and our friends in Washington say, hey, look, southbound policy does work, and we can work together to accomplish something big and good here. Thank you.
These are three good questions. The first and third seem to be linked, but I'll ask.
Xin Chang, it's nice to see you. I expect that in the coming years, Taiwan will have no ability to go through Beijing because Beijing doesn't seem to want to talk to Taiwan, and except under conditions that are very difficult for Tsai Ing-wen to accept for political reasons. I think that what Taiwan can do through the United States, you have to break it into two. One is working with Congress to get resolutions that, you know, aren't really that strong. Congress can't direct the diplomacy of the United States in most respects. The U.S. government has been most successful working behind the scenes, and we've done that for a long time, and I expect we'll continue to do so. To Joe Bosco's question, I think that what is most important right now is that the United States show that it is deploying capabilities in the Western Pacific that would be relevant to a war over Taiwan, and strengthen the view, which I think is common in PRC defense circles, that we would use those capabilities in the event of a war. I think that Beijing focuses mostly on what we have and what we do, and not necessarily on what we say.
I could ask Walter then to finish up very quickly on.
Sure. I guess I'll break that question down into two pieces to make it easy to answer. It's a very good question. How to sell the United States on it, how to make it something that we would support and we would do the sort of things I mentioned in my remarks. I think, first of all, you have to demonstrate to Americans that it's in our national interest to support it. And I think I laid out a few reasons why it would be in the U.S. interest. And I think you could sell people both on the Hill and in the administration on that. But I think the most important thing is that I think Tsai Ing-wen has to continue the line that she's taken really since before she was elected and before she was inaugurated. She has to be overly responsible in her use of language and that sort of thing. It's a little bit counterintuitive, but if she pushes too hard and she's too explicit and she provokes the Chinese, then it becomes something that it makes us hard to support. I'm not saying that's the way it should be. I'm just telling you that's the way it is. And that's the way it is also for the Southeast Asians. I think the reason why President Chen's efforts completely failed was because it was in the context of all the other nonsense that was going on at the time, and it made it impossible for the Southeast Asians to support. Second part of this is how she can prove it's working, and that also ropes into how you can sell it in Southeast Asia. I think it already is working in some ways. You can point to international arrivals in Taiwan. They're up from Southeast Asia considerably, almost making up for the numbers that have declined from China. And part of that is traceable to the changes in visa status that she's given to many of the countries in the region. So it's actually quantifiable that it has worked. There has already been a trend on the economic side that is positive for Taiwan. There's some good reporting out there about Taiwanese companies already beginning to diversify a little bit from China and investing more in Southeast Asia. And Southeast Asia has much more, relatively speaking, now than it did 20 years ago to offer vis-a-vis China. So she's only accentuating those trends if she does it right. And she has to claim credit for all the things that she doesn't necessarily have any power over. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you talk about Taiwanese taxpayers. I mean, the thing is, she's not spending very much money at all on this thing. And some people see that as a
as a problem that she should spend more. But she's, you know, who's going to really look at the numbers? She should take credit for everything that happens positive from here on out. Mm-hmm.
I was going to ask how One Belt, One Road meets up with southbound policy, but I won't. I mean, we're out of time. Thank you very much. It's been a great panel.
Everyone, you'll find lunch right outside, so please help yourselves. Around 12:45, we'll be reconvening for a luncheon.